Please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, our guest is Peter Lowe, a frequent guest here at the HR Power Hour, employment attorney with Brian and Isaacson, and a good friend. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me back.
You know, we have a plethora, and that's the big word today, plethora of topics.
Can you spell that?
Yeah, P. Plethora.
All right.
Of topics. Of topics to talk about today. And I think the idea here today is to hit a lot of topics that are relevant to employers today. Some are in the news. Some are important information that people should know. But kind of a general synopsis, not only national but statewide here in Maine, but also national things that are happening. So if that works for you, we'll start. How's that?
That sounds great.
All right. So let's start with something that is all over the news, and that is, believe it or not, things that are happening still with sexual harassment. There are CEOs stepping down still for sexual harassment issues. We've got issues at Uber. We've got engineers writing letters. We've got, just all this craziness going on. And my producer, Debbie Davis, asked this question off the air right before we came on, and I'll paraphrase it. In this day and age of diversity, sexual harassment training, and all these things that are trying to be done by the HR world, why are these things happening?
Well, that's a great question. Let's preface this, first of all, by saying the three of us here all worked in the 80s and 90s in the workplace. I think I'm fair to say we all did. And it would be misleading to say that things haven't changed and changed radically. And I say that not just from my experience in the workplace, but representing employers. So there was far more what we would now refer to as sexual harassment, other forms of harassment. It was accepted. You could talk about sex. You could joke about sex. You know, all of that was going on. There has been a lot of focus, frankly. Great deal happened in the early 90s, and not to rewind the clock too much, but there was the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill issue, which put huge focus on sexual harassment and changed the federal laws. However, to your question, there are still outliers. And I have a few theories on these, some legal, some non-legal, but from practicing for quite a few years now and dealing with scores and scores of sexual harassment cases, and I can say this probably with some degree of security as being male, is that there are males in particular, not to say that females can't be engaged in harassment, but the vast majority of the cases I've been involved in are males, and they are males who don't get it. And they don't get it, or they don't care to get it, and they don't respect the boundaries. The classic example I give it in sexual harassment training, is if a man and a woman are at work, and the woman has just broken up with her boyfriend, and she decides over lunch to tell the guy that personal fact. There are some guys out there, I've had the cases, who said, wow, you know, she's really getting personal with me. This is sort of the green light. And so they put a little toe towards that line, and then they put another toe, and they go right over the line. I'm very misleading if I say that's what everybody does, but there are people who do that. And I've seen it later when the guy is interviewed about sexual harassment and said, you know, what were you thinking? She's your coworker. You had training. There's posters on the wall. You can't do the stuff you did. And he said, well, you know, I'm just shocked because I thought it was welcome. I thought she liked me. I thought we would get along great. That's often the case. And there are some human instincts and some human behaviors that have been in existence from time immemorial that I think we will continue to see. So that's part of it.
I guess the thought process here is a lot of the ones that we read about are the sensational ones, yeah, right? Yeah, CEOs, yeah, presidents, yeah, yeah. Senior leadership. And it does amaze me that in this day and age, at that level, I certainly understand primal instincts, mm-hmm. right? Primal instincts take you to where you're going. I get it.
Right.
But at that level, the risk to themselves, to their families, to the organization, to the PR, you can just go through the laundry list. It does baffle the mind.
Yeah, yeah, it does. I did a presentation on this topic about a year ago. So I did a lot of research on CEOs and leaders. And if you do the research, it's not just the ones we can remember. There are scores and scores of them out there. And you always ask the question, what on earth were they thinking? And the simple answer is they were not. Another element of that is there's a degree, I do think, of power and arrogance that get harnessed together to think, I'm untouchable. I can get away with this. And for some degree, they do. It's not a sexual harassment situation as much, but you know the case of Tiger Woods is sort of the classic example, because when you learn what he was doing when he was one of the most famous athletes in the world, one of the most famous people in the world, and how could he imagine that a waitress or someone wouldn't go and talk to Access Hollywood or one of these? Of course they would in the end, but he didn't stop. He continued,
it's that celebrity mentality, right? Right. That you're above everybody else. You're more powerful than everybody else, I guess.
And I think I'm actually going to do a presentation next year at the HR conference on looking at the Uber case and Fox News and their sexual harassment scandals and what we can learn from them, but sort of some of the parallels and some of the differences. I do think what we're seeing is case after case coming out of Silicon Valley, and I think that that's right now a crucible for these issues, because you've got two things going on. You've got immense wealth and power being vested in young males, frequently very young. I mean, 31-year-old billionaires, 20-year-old mm-hmm. billionaires,
right.
20s. At the same time, you've got a corporate culture where, frankly, issues like that are going to explode and be called out, and social media is going to have a huge focus on them. So if you look at what happened at Uber, what really led to the demise of the CEO was a former employee not filing a lawsuit, not a class action, but what she put on her blog. The power one can have now to blog something or put something out on social media, and it just garnered attention. That
goes
was one
viral.
That was one person writing. Be one right. of think all employers out there. One of your former employees not giving a press conference, not filing a lawsuit, not winning a lawsuit, but going in writing up her experience and it getting that exposure it did. And that began an unraveling, and of course, other people then come forward and say, yeah, I had that experience with this individual or other individuals. I believe, and I don't want to misquote, I don't think, frankly, the Uber CEO, if I recall, it's not an allegation of it's in a very highly inappropriate, and there's gender discrimination issues. I'm not certain, in fact, there's been allegations explicitly of sexual harassment. So I want to just be
sure.
Cautious,
no, I understand that. And we're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney at Brown Isaacson. I'm your host, David Chulo. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. I also find that organizations sometimes, when they're doing this training, this either diversity training or anti-harassment training or any of the trainings, sometimes the CEO or the owner doesn't get the training. It's almost like everybody except them get the training. And I know sometimes it may be for a number of reasons, but I do find that that is the case, and probably something that if nothing else, this should set alarm bells off to anyone who hasn't had their CEO, president, or owner really take these trainings.
Yeah, no, you're dead right. I have done, and you probably have done as well, I'm sure you've done these types of trainings, and I'm always greatly encouraged if I do one and the CEO is there, not only because he or she is listening to the content, taking precious time, but time is precious for everybody in the organization. But secondly, the message it sends to everybody else in the room. I did one with an automobile dealership, and you have everybody in the room from the mechanics to the salespeople to the senior executives. And that's, I think, sends a strong, strong message. Yeah, every workplace here in Maine and nationally knows that you have to do some training, but the training can be so rote. It can be so check the box. Mm-hmm. It can be the old DVD or something you have to drag out the VCR for still. And it's people just, roll their eyes and kind of chuckle at it. Mm-hmm. So I think the so-called training is not particularly strong. I mean, I'll have a client call up, and I had one yesterday. And the person engaged in blatantly inappropriate, frankly, it was racist behavior. It wasn't sexual harassment, but really just blatantly inappropriate. The guy was in his probationary period. He had gone through an orientation and a training, and these types of issues emphasized. Doesn't mean it's the magic bullet, those issues surface.
Yeah, I think that goes to the point of even though. And to our producer's question, which, why is
that was a great question?
Of course, it was.
I think it's my producer. It's the best question you've ever asked me.
Did I mention Debbie Davis is my producer? Yes, I did, and she's awesome, and she's laughing over there behind the screen.
And you know what? You guys are going to sound great on this show. I'm going to make sure of it.
And yes, the words of Debbie Davis. I think that the key here is that let's not forget to, even at the highest level, bring them in on these decisions. As we all know, it all starts at the top anyways.
Right.
It all, if it isn't believed or practiced at the top, it's not going to happen throughout.
One of the biggest issues and challenges that HR face, and I'm sure you've got many folks out here listening who are in HR, is when HR has to deal with a senior executive, perhaps a rainmaker, perhaps one of the most influential people in your organization, and they have allegedly harassed somebody. And I've seen and been in those cases, and that can be a time. It's a very tough time for the HR person. The HR person may report to that person. It may be the CFO. It could be the CEO. It could be a family member in a business. And that's a time where the stakes are very high, and you really have to think about, do you go outside and you bring in somebody independent to investigate? But it's not easy.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So we've talked about this before, but I think it's very relevant. When do you really make that decision to go outside and bring in an investigator?
Yeah, I think you do it in a number of circumstances. One, where there is plainly a conflict, such as the one I've described, where the HR person may be investigating the person whom they supervise, or perhaps the owner of the business. And you're put, I think, in an untenable position. Secondly, when the complexity of the complaint is such a hard, tricky, sprawling complaint that it may be beyond that person's either time, resources, or sometimes ability. I've spoken many, many times on investigations, and it's a science. It's really something that there are a relatively few number of people who are very skilled and accomplished at doing it. And it will pay huge dividends if you do it right and you do it well. You have to be prepared for the outcome. You can't say, this is the outcome I want. You have to be prepared, once you do that, and that's the nature of doing an independent investigation. But I'm a huge believer that if you have a problem, you want to know about it. You don't want to find out about it because you receive a Maine human rights complaint in the mail and you start to read it and you go, oh my gosh, I put my head in the sand, but this is what may have been going on. it's really too late by then. If you've done your own investigation or had an independent investigation done, you gather the facts. I always say to clients, give me the facts. I can help you once I have the facts. We can solve your problems once you have the facts. It might not be easy. It may be costly at times. It certainly will be painful, but let's figure it out. So I think folks don't go outside enough. The resources are limited. I appreciate that, but I think it can be immensely valuable.
We're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney at Brown & Isaacson. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelly Flagg, General Manager of the Body Architect Fitness Center in Portland, Maine. I want to personally invite you to come meet us. If you've been considering joining a gym but haven't yet because you're a little nervous or just plain old don't like the gym, come see us. We have created a 30-day personal training experience just for you. Meet our trainers, try a few workouts, and use our facility for 30 days for just $79. Call 774-2196 or visit thebodyarchitect.com today.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. You know, Peter, today we're talking about stuff that just shouldn't happen. That's what I'm thinking. And again, we're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Brandon Isaacson, and we're talking about stuff that just shouldn't happen. I think that's what we're going to title this, Stuff That Just Shouldn't Happen. You know, we talked about in the first segment harassment and other issues that are just at the senior-most level of an organization and really shouldn't be happening. So one of the examples that we didn't talk about in the last segment was the Google engineer. And he wrote a paper, and it created a whole host of problems for Google. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation from case from many standpoints. And I say case, I'm not certain yet from reading news reports that he's filed litigation. This is a guy who was fired by Google after a paper that he had written got leaked out. He didn't leak it himself.
I think that's an important fact, isn't it?
It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw him interviewed. You know, he's plainly a very smart guy. He came across as very reasonable in the interview that I saw. What is interesting about this, and a little bit of background, he wrote this paper, and his explanation for the paper is he was responding to some of the diversity initiatives within Google. He's an engineer out in California. And he believes that some of the diversity initiatives and other things that are going on there are contrary to the best interests of Google. And he will say that he thinks that if somebody is going to get a position based upon their race or gender, he would see that as illegal and inappropriate. His paper is interesting to read. Anybody can look it up online. He talks about, within the paper, and I'm not going to do justice to it, but he talks about stereotypes. And I think we're at a age or time where the discussion of stereotypes can be misunderstood. It also can at times be a risky business for some folks. And so he talked about female characteristics and male characteristics and suitability within the tech world and within that engineering world that he's in. And certain phrases and certain things he said, he's certainly expressed some regret about a couple of things that he said. But what was really interesting and actually there's a good column guy I like to read, guy David Brooks, who writes in the New York Times, sort of the conservative voice in the New York Times. And he came out and said after Google fired this engineer that the CEO of Google should be fired for doing it. And so it's ignited a controversy on both sides. From the legal point of view, though, what's really interesting is, do you lose your job? Should you lose your job? And is the legal exposure for Google for firing somebody for expressing his personal opinions? And that's really what he did. It wasn't as if this paper was something that he was required to write at work. It wasn't part of his job, but he wrote this paper, and it plainly they're his opinions. And you know his take on it and the support he's receiving, quite widespread support from some circles, is Google. He refers to Google as an echo chamber, and he says that you know his views and the views of others like him are suppressed, and no more so than him being fired for expressing these views. The Google CEO will say that aspects of his paper violated their code of conduct. And so the legal standoff, I think, will in fact end up being quite technical. The important takeaway for anybody listening is there's no First Amendment right for an employee in a private workplace. So frequently I'll have clients call me and say, well, the employee said, I can't discipline him because he's got a right to free speech. And only for my public sector clients is that an issue. But in the private sector, sorry, you don't have free speech or First Amendment rights at work. You work for a private company. So Google doesn't have to worry that he's got a First Amendment claim. The claim I think that he might put together is that he was engaged in concerted activity with other employees.
This was retaliation.
To change working conditions, and then he went ahead and filed, I believe he filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, and this was retaliation for exercising his rights to concerted activity. I don't know whether he's going to be successful with that, but I think he's trying to thread that needle in bringing that claim. We talked earlier about sexual harassment and sexual harassment CEOs in Silicon Valley, and I feel like the pendulum swung one way, and you get the CEO fired, and then it swung the other way when this engineer got fired. And I'm not necessarily saying everything he wrote I agree with, but there's certainly a school of thought to say, is this really a basis to fire somebody?
Well, that's really the question, right? So HR comes under a lot of heat to answer questions for managers or management or leadership. We want to fire them, or we want to fire her.
Yep.
And a lot of times HR is the voice of reason behind, well, have you disciplined? What's the situation? What's the, all the protections for the organization. But at the end of the day, leadership still can, in most cases, in most states, depending upon rules and laws, let the person go, right? And especially if it's an at-will state, for example, even though we all know that that's a diluted reasoning and at-will really doesn't mean what it means. But the reality is they can make the decision to let somebody go at almost any reason at any time in those circumstances. So the question then becomes, how does HR thread that needle? How far do they push? How far can they go out on the line? And what do you say to an HR professional that says, okay, I'm trying to be the other side of the coin for a moment.
Right.
And how far do I push?
I love my job. I love being an employment lawyer and representing management. And sometimes some of the most challenging situation can be where I have a client who's dead set on, let's say, terminating an employee. And they feel very, very strongly about it. And I might speak with HR, who I can tell are anxious about it, nervous about it. They see some of the red flags. There may be some protected class issues that the person could raise. And I'll say, why don't we have a conversation where I'm involved and the CEO as well, who's driving this, or the CFO. And I'll play devil's advocate. I will. I'll say, look, I understand where you're coming from. I know you have to run a business. I know you need to make decisions. Let me paint the picture for where this could go, because everybody needs to make a decision with all of the facts. And I, the phrase I overuse is, I want your eyes wide open when you make this decision. And I will always say to the client, I don't make the decision. It's not my role. It would be wrong for me to make the decision. It is your decision, and you may decide to terminate if you want to or not. Let me tell you what the path looks like. So, that's the legal role. The HR role can be quite similar to that. There are times I can plainly tell where the HR person, again, back to, they report to that person. That person pays their paycheck.
Exactly right.
And that's where, as an outsider, there can be real value at times to come along and say, I don't have a dog in this fight. I don't work for this person. But let me just tell you, and, I've had many, many years seeing it go one way or go another way. I think the crucial aspect for HR people as well is, and it applies to lawyers too, you don't want to be that person who's always saying no. You don't want to be that person who's always saying, oh, it's a risky world out there, Because frankly, if you can't ultimately terminate an employee who you've given adequate notice and chances to, your organization, who's not performing, your organization is going to hurt, and especially a small one where you have a relatively few people, big ones as well. So it's a necessary evil of HR, employment law, that people are going to lose their jobs. It's going to happen, and it needs to happen. And the lawyer or the HR person who says, geez, everybody's within a protected class these days, I don't think we should do it, it shouldn't be in the job. They should not be in the job. It's figuring out, how can we do it? How can we do it to mitigate the risk? How can we position the company in the best way, or the employer in the best way? And so it's kind of a long answer to your question, but that's how I see it.
No, and I think you're right. I think this is a point of reflection, right? When you say, okay, if you're always worried about all the risk, you'll never do anything. It's interesting. I was just recently, a few weeks ago, at an advisory committee for an employer, right? So I'm on the advisory committee. Mm-hmm. It's one of the trusted advisors as an executive coach. And in the room are the individuals or the organization's attorney, accountant, benefits, coach, and I can go down the line of all the trusted advisors in this advisory committee, which is a great idea, by the way. I think it's a fabulous idea to once a year or twice a year get together and hear perspectives. And it's interesting when you do this, you see that the risk level between these organizational people. You get the attorney, which most of the time is the highest risk level. This is what could possibly happen. And if you listen to, and he'll even say, right, if you listen to me all the time, you would never do anything, right? That's the reality, right? That's it's not necessarily the answer, but what I'm saying, it's always the highest risk. On the other side, you have something, a person who's doing continuous improvement and pushing the organization to the absolute max, to doing everything it possibly can, which is not necessarily financially the right thing to do. So the CFO brings that back, and you just watch the back and forth.
Right.
And then you get HR talking about the people, you got the benefit people talking about the people, and you get this information. So decisions, as you said, have to be made with information. And if you don't have all the players at the table for that information, then it really becomes a very unbalanced conversation, mm-hmm. right? If you're only talking to one person about it, it's really good to get advice,
right?
In terms of to make that happen. We're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Brandon Isaacson. I think we'll move off the federal stuff for a few seconds and move into the state stuff. But you know what? Now that I think about it, this is a federal issue. Marijuana.
Oh, weed. I was just waiting. When are you going to talk about weed?
Well, okay.
Actually, the politically correct term is cannabis.
That's right, cannabis, dope.
So I shouldn't be saying weed.
No, right. So
you get my drift.
So I know in HR we have to be very careful what we say. But I have an HR, so I'll call it all three. We'll just put it all in there. The reality is that this has really become a nationwide movement, even more than it was. You know, medical marijuana was a huge movement. Now it's the legalization of marijuana. And Maine, where we are here in this state, is currently going through a ballot initiative that said, hey, it's going to become legal. But they put it on hiatus for a year to figure out what that means. And now they're starting to work on that. And I do know this is happening in other states, too. As I listen and watch the news, it's happening everywhere. Where are you seeing the trends? What are you seeing of what's going on in the employment side, in the marketplace? And how big an issue is this going to be?
It is a big issue. And what is happening is that cases are now working their way through the courts. And the first wave of cases, frankly, geographically, all came out of the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, and California, of course, Colorado, in the Rockies. And the employees or applicants were almost universally unsuccessful in suing a company based upon losing their job for their use of marijuana for a positive drug test. The people who write the laws, the lobbyists who propose the laws, from what I will call loosely the marijuana lobby, are smart, and they didn't like those court decisions. And some of those court decisions, when you read them, appear particularly harsh. Very, very sympathetic people who lost their jobs through no fault of their own, other than those were medical marijuana cases. So recently, there have been two decisions, one in Rhode Island and one in Massachusetts, where the employee applicant has been successful. And Maine employers in particular should pay attention to those, because those two statutes in those two states, Rhode Island and Massachusetts, look a lot more like our Maine statute, which is I'll use an English expression here, which nobody will ever follow, but the Colorado law and the Maine law are like chalk and cheese. Remember that.
Chalk and cheese.
Chalk and cheese.
Okay.
That's what we say when things are radically different.
It's like an apple and an orange.
It's like an apple and orange. It's chalk.
I'll bring it back to America.
Try eating cheese and try eating chalk. So they're like chalk and cheese. The Colorado law, in fact, is very favorable to employers. Maine law and the recreational law has a non-discrimination provision in it, which is going to be or could be very, very challenging for employers. What it says is that an employer may not discriminate. The words are different. In fact, it says may not refuse to hire an applicant based on solely on their use of recreational marijuana. I paraphrased it. And as many people have pointed out, there's no similar non-discrimination language for any other substance. There's nothing in Maine law that says alcohol has that special status, that you can't discriminate against a person based on their use of alcohol. Now, if they're an alcoholic, there's an ADA disability issue, which is a bit separate. So I've been following this issue closely for employers and was at the last hearing of the special committee up in Augusta,
which we're going to talk about in the next segment. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Brian and Isaacson, and we're talking about stuff that just shouldn't be. That's the title today, stuff that just
Are you referring to the cup of coffee you just made for me?
Well, you know,
it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought. I just have to tell people listening, I asked Dave for a latte, but he went out and he brought me something in a little plastic cup, which is dark and murky.
That would be radio station coffee.
And it's fine. I didn't use the coffee mate that came with it because I don't like the taste of it, but... anyway, back to weed.
No, back to weed, because it's about the same. It's dark and murky. I got to tell you, you never know where this show is going to go. You just don't.
I threw you off there, but it's all good.
So we were talking about, again, we're talking about the legalization of marijuana, a movement that's going across all states. We're currently talking about the situation here in the state of Maine, and you were talking about the committee that has just been formed and doing some voting. But talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the crucial aspect of what's happening right now in Augusta from the workplace point of view is whether or not this non-discrimination language remains within the legislation. And the last hearing that I attended before the committee had voted to remove the language that said that marijuana, in essence, to be frank, all marijuana users are a protected class. And this is a division on that committee about that, but the majority view that as going too far. And I think that's something that employers, as this process unfolds, want to pay close attention to. If you have strong opinions about that, speak up, talk to your local legislator or go and speak to the committee if you get the opportunity, because certainly as somebody who represents employers, I'm not expressing views one way or another about marijuana. We all have our opinions. We're entitled to our opinions. But ultimately, from my perspective, it has to be about the safety of the workplace. So I'm arguing a case involving somebody who worked as a crane operator or wanted to work as a crane operator and showed up intoxicated. And that's alcohol, that's not drugs. But that person made a claim under the ADA saying that they had a disability. And I raise that only because, if you have people who come to work and they're impaired and they're not fit, in certain workplaces, they're going to put people under grave risk themselves as well. And I think, marijuana raises that prospect, particularly in safety-sensitive positions. And we just don't know enough, and we don't have meaningful ways to test whether somebody's impaired. So if you strip employers of some of their current rights, I think ultimately, you're not going to keep the workplace.
Yeah,
safe.
I mean, I think of the liability factor, right? If an employer has the liability issue of keeping people safe, I think of the insurance side of this, right? So if somebody is impaired and something happens, then I could certainly see the insurance companies screaming, well, you didn't do what you were supposed to do, so now are you covered? I see OSHA screaming because it's federally, it's a different conversation. I just see there's so much unknown to this, really, and all the different sides it's going to play out on the next year is kind of frightening.
Well, you and I have been around employers long enough, working with employers. Employers want clarity. They want a level of certainty. They want to know what the playing field looks like. They know it won't always go their way. They know the legislation, they may not support gets passed. But if it's clear, they'll adapt. They'll work around
it. Absolutely. Just tell us what the rules are.
Tell us what the rules are. You hear that from business people the whole time. And they're practical people, and we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. But when it's so wide open, so unclear, you and I have given countless presentations on this topic, and you can't give people definitive answers. And you can tell it gets frustrating for them. So it's a non sequitur in some ways, but the overtime issues that we've talked about in the past are another reminder of that. Businesses want to know, okay, where are we with overtime? What is the overtime rule? And when it's shifting and moving and different things are happening in Washington, it's just an ongoing source of frustration.
Well, since we're talking about that here, and we have a few more minutes in this segment, where is that right now? I did see a ruling last month that said that the overtime rules were illegal.
Did you notice that seamless transfer I did to overtime for you?
You would think that somebody wants to be a radio show host.
What do you call that when you move from one thing to another?
Subtle. We're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney at Brand Nyson, and the next HR Power Hour radio show host. Seamless transitioning in training. That's it. Seamless transition in training. So as we're talking about the new overtime rules again, last month I saw a ruling that said that the overtime rules were not legal. And that I understand that at this point, nobody's going to challenge that from a federal level. I also know there was an open period where people could comment. So you've got this mixed signal coming out of Washington. Are they going to do something? Are they not going to do something? Now it's not legal. It could be legal. What do we got going on?
Yeah, so good summary of what's happened recently. So, of course, the final rule that was passed under President Obama was put on hold. I think it was the day before Thanksgiving last year. And that's been wending its way through the courts. And this judge in the Eastern District of Texas, a federal judge, just by way of information, was an Obama appointee to the court, struck down the rule. And so finally a judge has said that rule, which was suspended, the Department of Labor exceeded its authority. What is, again, a source of some confusion is the judge didn't say the Department of Labor lacks the authority to set a new salary threshold. So the $23,000 and change potentially could be increased by the Department of Labor. But the judge, in his succinct 100 pages or so, only us lawyers can take 100 pages to say, yeah, you went too far, mm-hmm. said that the increase to, was it $47,000
and change,
was excessive, and explains why. So I think there's a view out there, and I think within the business community, that the $23,000 should increase, but it shouldn't increase nearly as dramatically, and maybe there should be some regional allowance. The new Secretary of Labor, not quite so new now, but still fairly newly minted, testified about potentially a $33,000 number. But it's very hard to know because there will be other priorities. There are other things going on. It's not on the front burner, clearly, at this point. And as you mentioned, there was a request for some comment on this issue.
And if you had gone on and done that, which I did actually, you would see that there were some really actually decent questions on that questionnaire asking about regional, should be a regional mm-hmm. type discussion? Should there be rural and urban? And I thought, those are reasonable questions, of which the answer, in my opinion, yes, right? I mean, you should not have the same wage concentration of New York City, L.A., and Chicago and Miami as you would have in Augusta, Maine, Boaz, Alabama, right? Something Utah.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, it's just the reality of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the one thing that all of the focus, because last year, this is what we were talking
That's
about.
That's all we talked about.
So HR people were working on and figuring out, and lawyers were saying, you know, the sky's just going to fall in as we do. But what it did make people do, or some people do, quite a lot of people, is look at classifications and figure out, did they have people correctly classified as exempt or non-exempt? Because that's the most crucial issue. And that's what employers should continue to do to make sure. Because a lot of the effort to change the threshold is based on a lot of misclassifications, and there are a lot of misclassifications. So, employers out there, continue to look at your classifications, make sure you're getting people right. Because the number one class action lawsuit, I believe, still in the country, are wage and hour cases against employers. Now, they're usually bigger employers, so the small employers don't get on the radar as much, but they are based on issues such as misclassification and particularly overtime. So it's not just making sure you comply with what the Department of Labor says, and in case you get a Department of Labor audit, it's crucially, you don't want a group of your employees saying, hey, for the last 3 years, I should have been a non-exempt employee, and you owe me overtime. Our friends at, this is a slightly different case, but right here in Maine, the Oxford Comma case, the one involving Oakhurst Dairy, the misclassification, and that was based on the missing comma, by some estimates, was going to cost Oakhurst Dairy $10 million based on drivers not being properly compensated based on this unique issue in the law, which incidentally the Department of Labor and now the legislature have corrected. So right. The comma went in.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting – and I've seen that that's going up for other states are debating this comma issue now. It's a you would never know that a comma has so much power.
Yeah.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Kelly Flagg, General Manager of the Body Architect Fitness Center in Portland, Maine. I want to personally invite you to come meet us. If you've been considering joining a gym but haven't yet because you're a little nervous or just plain old don't like the gym, come see us. We have created a 30-day personal training experience just for you. Meet our trainers, try a few workouts, and use our facility for 30 days for just $79. Call 774-2196 or visit thebodyarchitect.com today.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we've been talking with Peter Lowe, appointment attorney at Brandon Isaacson. And we've been talking about things that just shouldn't happen. That's what I'm saying. They should not happen. You know, it's interesting, Peter, as we wrap up the show today, HR has a big challenge sometimes to be the voice of reason at times, to be pushing for the right thing to happen. And sometimes leadership wants things to happen faster than they do, right? I mean, I think you see that especially when it comes to bringing in the attorney and, you know, sometimes they go, oh my God, this is going to require, you know, more time and more money and more energy. When you think about today's show and the things we talked about, how often and what would you recommend that HR really does when they think about bringing in an attorney for these type of things? When's the right time?
I tell people that there's a point where the HR person is dealing with an employment matter, and it could be a termination, it could be a wage issue, it could be, you know, an internal complaint of harassment. And, I, you know, it sounds odd, but I say trust your gut, because I think we've all been in that situation where something doesn't feel right. And I know that's often when my clients will call me, because they're very knowledgeable. They deal with lots of issues. They handle a lot of issues very well themselves. But there's that one that's keeping them awake. You know, they went home and they were still thinking about it. They got up in the morning and that was the one thing they thought, oh, something isn't right about this. And I often say, you know, in that situation, if we have a conversation, it may be relatively simple, but trust your instinct, because I think often in those situations where an experienced HR person says, you know, I was just worried about this. I was concerned about what this meant for the organization. There is no substitute for then talking with somebody about it. And, you know, one of the things that frankly, we are able to offer as lawyers is that's a confidential conversation. That's a privileged conversation. So if the HR person goes to talk with a colleague at work and says, you know, I think we could be sued because I think there's some sort of gender thing going on here, but it's a little subtle below the surface, that's all discoverable in terms of litigation. That's something that if it's written in an email, when that person sues, they ask for all the email, and there it is. So there's that confidentiality that goes with it. So I know that's a, sort of a general answer to a more specific question, but you know, I will say as well that the clients who are proactive. The clients who look for the 10 minutes of advice or the half an hour of advice or an hour of advice are probably going to incur far less expense than the client who calls after the main human rights complaint comes in. Because that main human rights complaint may cost them $20,000 at main human rights. And then if that case goes to federal court, it may cost them $250,000. So, you know, it's that ounce of prevention type of motto. The proactive people, certainly no guarantee. The other thing that I would say is people always decide on Fridays that they're going to take some drastic action. Like they've waited 5 years, and then on that Friday, they must terminate that person. Pause. Think about it. Yeah. Wait till Monday.
It's true.
You may still do it, but that's so commonplace.
We're talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney at Brandon Isaacson, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
We've been talking about things that just shouldn't happen. But you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VerylDana.com.
This is Joanna Bowers from VerylDana. We all know that non-exempt hourly employees are required to accurately track their hours worked and that you should use their reported hours to ensure that they are paid properly. Many employers also require that their salaried exempt employees track their hours. Does your organization do this? If not, you may want to consider implementing this requirement for a few reasons. First, if an issue ever arises regarding whether the salaried employee should actually be classified as non-exempt and you're required to pay the employee for past due overtime, you have an actual record of the number of hours, including overtime hours, that the employee worked. In the absence of this record, a court is able to rely on the employee's own testimony regarding the number of hours that they typically worked. Second, requiring salaried employees to track their time is helpful for managing employees' hours of work and benefits. For example, it helps you make sure that employees are accurately tracking their use of vacation and/or sick time. Third, tracking this time can help employers and supervisors better understand employees' workloads. If an employee is frequently working more hours than expected, it may suggest that another employee should be hired. Or, if there is a significant imbalance between the number of hours worked by two employees with similar responsibilities, it may suggest that there needs to be closer management of the employees' workloads to make sure that work is distributed more evenly. For more information about how to require exempt employees to track their time, contact me or another member of VerylDana's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerylDana.com. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBRadio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success. And stay tuned for Inside Portland with Bob Witkowski.